Good morning and welcome. As you probably know, this Sunday is part of a series of panels on ancient wisdom, ancient theosophy, as found around the world. And this morning, we're discussing ancient theosophy in Africa and the Middle East. And we would call to your attention that on the usher's table is an amazing compendium, a chart of ancient theosophy in the Americas that was compiled for you, and you may pick up on the way out. It is a very valuable piece of research done by a student, so we would recommend picking it up. Next Sunday, we will skip our part of this panel in a way, although certainly the meaning and symbolism of Easter is part of ancient theosophy, and that's what we will be having next Sunday. On Wednesdays, we're studying the ocean of theosophy. We're studying cycles. We're in the chapter on cycles, and that meeting begins at 7:45 and lasts till 9, and the reference library open, as usual, from 5:30 to 7:30. The work done at this lodge or any United Lodge is on the basis of volunteering, voluntary donations of time, of energy, of service, and of course, of money. It is voluntary donations of money that keep this building open for the public to come as they will to attend these free meetings. We would remind you that Saturday, May 3rd, there is a special Interlodge Symposium with students from D.C. and New York, and it will be held here on Saturday, May 3rd from 11 to 4:30. You can pick up a flyer at the book table. The lodge, any lodge, every lodge, operates on the basis of one and the same declaration found on the back of our periodical. And that declaration is a statement of universal principles. It is worth studying itself as a spiritual document. That's okay. It is completely on the basis of independent devotion. In other words, this Philadelphia Lodge is independent of any other ULT and yet follows the same policy, the same aim and purpose and teaching, the original writings of theosophy as found in the works of H.P. Blavatsky and William Q. Judge. It is, of course, then, totally open to all, regardless of gender, background, condition. It is truly a brotherhood, and anyone is welcome to attend and participate. The declaration ends with a statement that requires thought. The true theosophist belongs to no cult or sect, yet belongs to each and all. Now, our subject this morning is broken down into two sections, Africa and the Middle East. Almost anyone seeing this sign, ancient theosophy in Africa, would immediately relax and go, oh, how nice, we're going to hear about Egypt. We all know and we all love Egypt, and it's definitely a proof of ancient theosophy in Africa. But Egypt is just a little part of Africa. There's an entire continent. What about the rest of Africa? Well, we don't hear about it because we don't have the proofs. We don't have the documents that would show us, or the hieroglyphics and the pyramids and everything else that would indicate to us that these same ancient ideas were there and were understood and delivered and taught to the people. So without that proof, what can we do? What's the point of this attempt at a search of Africa? Well, we owe a great deal to one individual. His name was Patrick Bowen. He was the youngest child of Robert Bowen, and every student of theosophy knows and feels gratitude to Robert Bowen, who studied with HPB the last few years of her life, and he wrote How to Study Theosophy, and then went to her and questioned her, is this right? Is that what you... And she said, yes. And so it got published. Every student of theosophy loves Robert Bowen for what he did. But his youngest child, Patrick, could not have cared less about theosophy. He was with his father traveling through Africa when he was about 10 years old for a couple of years. He fell in love with the languages and the modes of thought, and he had a very natural ability to pick up languages, difficult languages. He was scheduled to be a scholar in Ireland, and he rejected that. As a teenager, he took off and he went to Africa. He joined the intelligence division of the South African Rifles and rose to be a captain in that. He, as a youngster, became intrigued about Africa because, and we want to say this right, an Isanusi, which we call a witch doctor, which is pretty stupid because kind of confuses the terms. The Isanusi told him the following when he was a child, hearing that Patrick was going to be instructed by a missionary because his father wanted him to learn the ways of religion and of white people, even though they were there in Africa. The Isanusi, whose name was Mankanyezi, which means the Starry One, said to him, and we quote, "Your teachers, the missionaries, are doubtless learned men, but why do they strive to force their beliefs on us without first learning what our beliefs are? We teach the common man that he has a body, that within the body is a soul, and within the soul is a spark of something we call Itongo, which the common man then interprets as the universal spirit of the tribe. We teach that after death, the soul, after hovering for a space near the body, departs to a place called Place of the Beasts, and for a period, according to the strength of the animal nature, the soul remains until it moves onward to a place of rest. There it sleeps till a time comes when it dreams that something to do or to learn awaits it on earth. Then it awakes and returns through the Place of Beasts to earth and is born again as a child." That is right out of the ocean of theosophy. Just different words to describe it. Again and again, till at last the man becomes true man, and his soul, when he dies, goes straight to its rest, and thence, after a space, having ceased to dream of earth, moves on and becomes one with that from which it came, the Itongo. Then does man know that instead of being but himself, apart, he is truly all the tribe, and the tribe is he. This is what we teach. But the belief of us, wiser ones, is something far wider and greater, though similar. We know that the Itango is not the mere spirit of the tribe, but is the spirit within and above all men, even all things, and that at the end, all men being one in spirit are all brothers in the flesh. Mankanyezi said of himself, he was only a common brother, not an elder, not a teacher, just a common brother. But his elder brother, he would be in contact with him, never in the flesh, only through the mind. And he spoke of the ranks from the learner, the beginner, all the way up to the master. And he said, at least one guardian exists in every tribe and nation throughout Africa, protecting and giving out the wisdom which comes from old. Every nation and every tribe has such a brother. He predicted that Patrick Bowen would meet this elder brother of whom he spoke. And Patrick did, many years later, in a remote, inaccessible village, a small community of people who identified themselves with their Bantu neighbors as Zulus, but in color varying from brown to pure white. The chief of this community bore the Zulu name of Mandlalanga, Strength of the Sun, and he was extremely friendly towards Patrick, explaining that he and his people were actually Berbers from North Africa. One day, Patrick brought up the subject of the amazing, distant happenings would be known very quickly throughout the whole of Africa. And he was told, thought is speedier than the electric spark and needs no wires for its conveyance. All it requires is a brain to dispatch it and another to receive it. Would you believe if I told you that I and others of the brotherhood to which I belong can transmit our thoughts one to the other, no matter how far apart our bodies may be? Patrick naturally asked for an explanation for this, and he was told, to attempt to explain our science to you would be rather like trying to explain differential calculus to a child who is ignorant of simple addition. However, if you will, I will take you as a pupil and teach you the simple addition of our lore. I can teach, but I cannot guarantee that you will learn. So Patrick became his pupil for a couple of years, and he gave an explanation. Mandlalanga is a master or teacher in the brotherhood mentioned by Mankanyezi. He is an Atlas Berber, an initiated teacher called Melo Moya, and has traveled in Europe, Asia, and America. He speaks English and other European languages perfectly, but his talks with me were conducted in the secret Bantu tongue, Isenzu, the continued existence of which few Europeans are aware. Already we have seen great similarities between what is understood by these of the Brotherhood, but this is right out of the Secret Doctrine or the Bhagavad Gita. It, Itango, the universal spirit, is all that ever was, is, or ever shall be, conceivable or inconceivable. The Itango is all things are of it, but the sum of all things is not the Itango. The Itango is all the wisdom there is. All wisdom is of it, but all wisdom conceivable is not the Itango. All substance, all power, All wisdom is of it, and it is in them and manifests through them. But it is also above them and beyond them, eternally unmanifest. Man, who is of the Itango, can never know the Itango while he is man. All he can know of it are certain manifestations which come within the range of his perceptions. I think we brought that statement from the Gita. Well, we think we lost it. We'll come back to it, perhaps. Melo Moya told Patrick that he was himself in possession of a very ancient manuscript in the secret tongue. If you go to the Secret Doctrine, you'll find quite a few mentions of ancient manuscripts that are scattered throughout the world. He said it was a translation of records found in one of the ancient ruined cities of South Africa, and it is hinted that it was near Zimbabwe. Bowen was permitted to copy and publish three fragments from this source, the same source as all esoteric traditions. He called this work The Sayings of the Ancient One. On the book table, you will find this morning a copy of The Sayings without any commentary by Bowen, and you'll also find an online list. Because online, you can read some of the commentary. But we'd like to close with a few quotes from The Sayings of the Ancient One, reminding you that, according to the teacher, the Ancient One was not a being, but was wisdom itself. And this was wisdom offered to the student or the learner. Many cautions. Knowledge and truth can never be reached by any easy and pleasant way. They can never be found by cunning device of the mind of man. Truth must be reached through the strength of the heart. Find your reward in work continued and never in work completed. Rejoice if your lot be happy, but if it be miserable, rejoice also. Despise not your imperfections and grieve not for your failings, but understand their nature and make them steps upon which to mount. Patrick asks, why are the words of the teacher so vague and paradoxical? And why does he say so much about what has to be achieved and so little about how to achieve? And the answer is, works written by those with real knowledge are not, as they appear to be, uninstructed mere guidebooks setting out the configuration of the universe. They are fields of experience wherein consciousness may exercise itself. They are fields of experience where consciousness may exercise itself and so gain direct knowledge of the laws of universal nature. Let the student impress this last sentence on his mind and think about it until he realizes its full significance. Now we move from Africa to the Middle East. It's that easy.
We go.
Well, the Middle East, as we all know, has always been like a melting pot of many different kinds of religions and philosophies. And there have been periods of rest, periods of war, but we find, though, that during the period between 96 and 180 AD, regarding the Roman Empire, there was religious tolerance and understanding. There was a love of culture and education. And there was, for the most part, this peace and tolerance was generally throughout the Roman Empire, except there were two exceptions to this era of tolerance, one being the Orthodox Jews, who felt they were the chosen people and Jehovah was the only God, and Orthodox Christianity, who felt as though all other religions were idolatry. They were against any kind of education that was not faith-based, and they were against any kind of artistic expression. So we will look then at two of the main philosophies going on at that time in the Middle East. And the first one we'll look at is not gnosis, which is divine, which is knowledge of the divine, and it flourished in Egypt during the second and third centuries, and it was passed down orally from teacher to pupil. And the idea of Christian separateness, it brought about intolerance and slander and ridicule towards many of the Gnostic fathers. And it caused them to go underground because they weren't able to worship out in the open. And the Gnostic fathers felt anyway that these people that were persecuting them were not ready to hear these ideas anyway. They felt as though they should not make the study of the inner life a public debate. And three of the major Gnostic fathers who were really pinpointed for all this ridicule, they were Basilides, Marcion, and Valentinus. Basilides was the founder of one of the most philosophical Gnostic sects. He was a student of the esoteric and philosophical aspects of Christianity. He taught that salvation belongs to the soul alone, not to the body. And he also taught the same three fundamental propositions that theosophy puts forth of deity, law, and evolution. And he also taught karma and reincarnation. Marcion viewed Jesus as a divine being who was sent here to reveal a spiritual religion. He did not agree at all with the biblical interpretation of Jesus' life and birth, claiming that those stories were actually hiding ideas, true spiritual ideas, that people were not ready to hear yet. And he taught that Jesus put forth a universal philosophy that could not be confined to only one religion. Valentinus was educated in Alexandria, and it was while he was in Alexandria that he learned about the philosophy of the Gnostics. And he felt as though the original source of the systems of religion have been sprung from the Gnostic ideas. And there were many Gnostic groups, and they all were putting out basically the same ideas, but there were also some differences. So what he did was he pulled them all together, he collated them all, and he put it out as a universal system, which would include all the different Gnostic philosophies. Now, all three of these Gnostic fathers were excommunicated from the Orthodox Church because they felt as though they were teaching heresy, and they were failing to put forth the uniqueness of the Christian Church. The Gnostics also followed the idea that there was no anthropomorphic God who created the world out of nothing. They put forth the belief that deity was omnipresent, boundless, and immutable, the first cause. So, you know, this is straight theosophy with their talking. They also was the idea that the principle of non-manifestation, with the logoi from it as the manifested deity. The Gnostics also taught the law of periodicity or cycles, karma and reincarnation, and that the soul was immortal. The immortal principle was known as the Christos, and they also put out the idea of the sevenfold nature of man and the universe. So, and we find it amazing that from back then, where nothing was written down, and until now, these are the exact ideas that we study here at the Lodge. So the other group we will look at now are the Essenes. And they were thought to be a religious sect or a brotherhood, and they were Jewish, and they flourished in Palestine from about the 2nd century BC to the end of the 1st century AD. And the New Testament does not mention them at all, but accounts were given by Josephus, Philo of Alexandria, and Pliny the Elder. And they all kind of differ in minor ways, but it was felt as though that all these different groups of the Essenes were different. The Essenes themselves, there were very many differences. They kept themselves separate from other people, as they felt as though life was polluted if you lived in a city, and we were looking at Jerusalem at that time, and they lived in the wilderness. They were ascetics, living a life of extreme self-denial, and in order to become an Essene, it took at least 3 years as a postulant, including denial of food, and they received minimal provisions. Then after 3 years, if they succeeded in living through all this, they took an oath, and they joined the group. They were celibate, and we always found that to be a little bit curious, because they also thought that women were evil, conniving, jealous, and that there shouldn't be any mixing of men and women together. And some of the groups actually adopted children because they didn't want to have children of their own, because they felt as though it would be a distraction. So we find it very unusual that they lasted as long as they did. So we're guessing that they must have adopted an awful lot of kids. It was just very strange. All food, activity, money, property, etc., were held in common. So it was very much a true brotherhood. And they always kept their homes open to any kind of travelers. If anybody was hungry, they needed help. And it didn't have to be an Essene. It could be anybody. They took them in, fed them, and made them well. They also believed in the immortality of the soul. They engaged in many virtuous activities. But the readings that that we looked at, it said that they were hoping for a reward in the afterlife. So even though they were doing all these virtuous things, they were doing it for a purpose so that things would go well for them in the afterlife, not just because it was their duty and they were supposed to do that. They felt that the body was defiled and that it was a prisoner and that it was a prison to the soul. At death, the soul was set free from this prison and would rise to a heavenly world. They believed in meditation and finding the sacredness in all activities. Apparently, and we'll be going into the Dead Sea Scrolls momentarily, but apparently there's some writings in the Dead Sea Scrolls that actually lists the type of day the Essenes had, waking up early and pray and eat, but they were focused on finding the sacred in the mundane, that everything they did had a divine purpose. And their teachings were verbal and usually regarding, they were doing it symbolically and in allegories. Though their life was vigorous and ascetic, it was based on love and obedience, love for fellow man, to live in peace and virtue. The Dead Sea Scrolls are considered to be some of the most influential religious texts ever found. They were discovered in a cave in 1947 by a shepherd. Eventually, there were 11 caves that were discovered that had these texts in it. But the largest amount and interest would be in the initial one at Qumran, Israel. They found over 800 documents, and they were made out of animal skin, papyrus, and forged copper. And the texts have deepened our understanding of the Bible and shed light on the histories of Judaism and Christianity. There are sections of every book of the Jewish Old Testament except for the book of Esther. And one of them expounded on the book of Genesis, another one detailing regulations that challenge the religious laws practiced by priests. And they feel as though that this finding may be the connection of teachings being transferred from verbal to written, because prior to finding these texts, nothing had ever been written down of these teachings. Although Jesus was never mentioned by name, there is a mention of a Son of God and Son of the Most High. And also found there were unknown hymns and prayers, commentaries, mystical formulas, and a very early edition of the Ten Commandments. And it also is believed that the scrolls may represent a connection between Judaism and Christianity. The majority of the scrolls were written between 2nd century BCE and the 2nd century CE. During this time, there were different Judean groups that were struggling, and there was like a power struggle going on in the political and religious leadership. So the Dead Sea Scrolls, the scrolls were felt as though to be in danger. So the feeling is this is why they were hidden. And they were written in Greek and Aramaic. Now, there are conflicting professional opinions as to who wrote the scrolls. The most popular one is that the Essenes were the ascetic group of Jews, and that one of the things that they did
that they were scribes, and they were devoted to writing and preserving sacred texts. So the feeling, the strongest evidence points to the Essenes, but it's not definite. And where they lived, I mean, they do, they are, there are digs around, and they're finding the remnants of buildings. But the settlement is also under disagreement as well as who actually lived there and what the settlement was for. There's evidence that it might have been a fort, a tannery, perfume manufacturing, and as well as a religious community. But as was said, the feeling is that the scrolls would be attributed to the Essenes. And we just wanted to end with a very interesting quote from HPB. "Unless we mistake the signs, the day is approaching when the world will receive the proofs that only ancient religions were in harmony with nature and ancient science embraced all that can be known. Secrets long kept may be revealed, books long forgotten and arts long time lost may be brought out to light again. Papyri and parchments of inestimable importance will turn up in the hands of men who pretend to have unrolled them from mummies and stumbled upon them in buried crypts. Tablets and pillars whose sculptured revelations will stagger theologians and confound scientists may yet be excavated and interpreted." Now, this was written by HPB, so it was before, obviously it was before the Dead Sea Scrolls were discovered.
Long before.
Yeah. So we'll take your questions.
To follow up on that last comment, we understand that for centuries, the only thing we knew about the Gnostics is what their enemies wrote about them until the so-called Gnostic Gospels were, was it in the 60s they were?
Page, wasn't that?
Yeah, accidentally discovered. And then they had the actual sources of those hidden aspects of Christianity.
We always found it fascinating that if you wanted to know what Origen, for instance, wrote, you had to go to the Catholic Church who published the things he said that they set out to prove were wrong. And it's the way many times the truth was kept, and we still have it. Yes?
I was just wondering how the Essenes could have the true theosophical knowledge, yet consider women inferior. Is that actually correct? Did that happen?
Well, the thing is... Oh, sorry. How could the Essenes be considered as being theosophical if they held women in such low esteem? Well, we think that part of the question would be that they were only human, and that we wonder if this was like the starting of these beliefs. We're not really sure.
Well,
why.
Look at the Gita. It's in the Bhagavad Gita. It's in the Mahabharata that women are less, lower, and supposed to be controlled, educated, and a possession, literally, of the husband. The fact is, it's more tribal than anything else, and those with real wisdom never felt that way, because at the same time you had someone like Hypatia, who was considered the wisest human and teacher in Alexandria. So you have both sides of it. As you said, they were They were human. We had the same thing here with the Shakers.
Yeah.
Only they didn't adopt children.
Right.
They disappeared.
They disappeared. Right. Yes.
It reminds us of that article by Mr. Judge on theosophical movement and the Theosophical Society. And he reminds us that we need to keep in our minds the difference between theosophy as wisdom mm-hmm. and those that try to live up to it.
Mm-hmm.
And its vehicle in the world versus the wisdom in essence. And so we're aspiring.
And we think, too, that you know we're looking at karma. So they were bringing forward from the past those ideas, and we would hope that in the future there would be, you know, a learning of that feeling that women are less than.
We had an example of what you just said here at a meeting a number of years ago. A reporter came and was asking questions during, you know, a regular meeting, and afterwards wrote the most scathing report of how stupid we all were, that there wasn't one person here with wisdom because we couldn't answer her questions. So it's putting the wisdom on a person is a mistake. Like, we're students, we're just giving out what we have read and studied, but if you want it, you have to read and study it yourself. And then teach us. Yes.
Well, we see the idea of men and women being separated in Judaism. And the Orthodox Jews are very separate mm-hmm. in their approach. But even it's sort of assimilated through the whole religion. But unfortunately, that never holds to be true. Because the women are probably stronger than men, in most cases.
Well, isn't that what happens when you imprison something? The power and the strength has to come out, or you'd be totally defeated. But we have often wondered and would really like to be able to look backwards and see how that started. Because if you go back historically, it was a teamwork, always. The one requiring the other. And according to theosophy, you're not just male every incarnation. Mm-hmm. You're not just female either. So we have to bring out the best of the male or female of whatever incarnation we are in.
And it's interesting, the Quakers, even now they sit separately. But the women are not held in low esteem. I mean, they are elevated because of all the work that they do. But it's interesting that as much as they're looked up to, the groups still sit separate.
Ideas. Ideas rule the world. And if we have a dumb idea and we all agree on it, we're going to live by it. Yes.
In some way, it's interesting that the Catholic Church actually revealed some women by elevating them to sainthood.
Well, elevating them to sainthood, but keeping them from having any direct influence or accomplishment in the human sense. Well, you make a saint out of something, you put it up on the wall, and it's not going to bother you. And women will not be put up on the wall. Yes.
My question is regarding the Africa part. Twofold question. First, whatever happened to Peter?
Patrick.
Patrick.
All right, let's stop and we'll come back to your second question. When he left Africa and came back to Ireland, someone very, very well known to all students of theosophy took a great interest in him, and that's George Russell, the Irish poet A.E., who was at that time the president of the Hermetic Society in Dublin.
And when A.E. went to come to America, he turned the society over to Patrick and told him to write his experiences, which he did in a book called The Occult Way. We have out there with the sayings for you the way you can go online and read many of Bowen's writings. He died in 1940. He remained a student of theosophy and wrote passionately about the effort of the individual to overcome their own stupidity. In other words, we stand in our own way. So your second?
The second question was an interesting comment you made about that there is a master or enlightened one watching over every country, including those countries in Africa, I would suppose. And my dilemma is, thinking back 20 years about the Zimbabwe and the Hutus and the Sunnis and whatever they were, the butchery there that went on where 2 million of those people were killed.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm just wondering what the master watching over that is thinking, and how could that be allowed even, or maybe, I'm just...
Wait a minute, we have, I think, a bit of confusion about what a master is. Is a master a controlling person or individual that keeps law and order? Is that what it is?
So what does he do then? I mean, watching over a country in chaos.
No, didn't we? If we said watching over the country, that would be wrong. It was watching over the wisdom that it was protected. In other words, you have a witness on the scene that contains that wisdom and is there for someone who is seeking it out, truly.
Yet they're not allowed to interfere with the karma of any person or nation.
And didn't we have HPB's work here, done here in this land, and look what we've been up to? So it's a question of individual souls and their choices, which is why we have the phrase, come ye out and be ye separate. Make your higher intentions known and fight for what's right when you can. Yes.
Maybe my geography is a little off. I don't think so. What about Ethiopia? Is that, that's in Africa, correct?
Yes.
Check.
No, and I had to ask, what really is the Middle East? Because I get all confused.
Well, there are stories or legends of a great civilization being there. And that...
in Addis Ababa.
And, you know, even today there's... mystical society that you can find within that culture. And the other question, or statement, is that about the same time as the Essenes, there were the Therapeutae, and they were healers. And they weren't, we don't know their motive, but we're sure that they're willing to heal people. They're very altruistic. Mm-hmm.
Wasn't it Haile Selassie, the emperor, and people will often use that, I don't know, that awareness that there's something deeper or purer or more true or wise, and literally cash in on it. I mean, we find it fascinating to go into any bookstore and walk down row after row after row of self-help books, and they're all quoting the Buddha. They don't know it sometimes, but that's all it is ancient wisdom put into today's language. It is truly a tragedy, because if people would realize the source is not the individual person in California or Harvard or wherever they're writing from, it is spiritual wisdom that was freely given.
Yes.
Last week, in discussing wisdom in the Americas, ancient wisdom, a reference was mentioned to continents in the past that may have been a bridge between. How might that, or in your research, did you see, find any explanation how this ancient wisdom got to those areas of Africa? No, I know we're speaking of Egypt here, but to those more remote areas, or how the wisdom was out there?
Nothing to do with bridges, but individuals like the Berbers, the man that Patrick studied with. The Berbers came down from Europe into North Africa and then down into South Africa and took up the position as one of the brothers. So it would seem, although we have no way of proving it, that it probably traces back to Atlantis and before the sinking of Atlantis, and we mean well before the 11,000 years that are given, that those with knowledge came and set up various locations from which those with wisdom could go out and be those brothers and instructors on the scene.
And in the Middle East, the Tigris and the Euphrates rivers, the studying back that far, there were civilizations that were thriving there. And we did not find any information about how they got there. But then in that area, there's that's where the Garden of Eden was supposed to be. So that seems like it was where all these ideas were generated. It seems like the Tigris and the Euphrates area. Yes?
Well, let's not forget the Druzes and the Sufis are in the Middle East.
Mm-hmm.
And the Druzes,
time is a factor.
Yes.
Yeah, no, this is ancient, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
But they're there now.
And there's a lot of...
But where did they get their knowledge?
Do you know him?
No. The Druze were around in the first century and mostly in Lebanon and Syria.
Yeah.
But they were considered mystics, mm-hmm. as well. And they were persecuted by the Orthodox Christians and the Islamists. And again, they're the one... Everything was passed down verbally with them. And we thought it was interesting that they were considered to be the Sikhs of Asia Minor.
And the Sufis, of course, are the Muslim mystics. And we have a lot of Sufi materials being published now. It is one and the same source all the way through. There is one truth and various expressions of it through different civilizations. Way in the back, you had your hand.
We were thinking also, in ancient times, the land masses that were on our globe this idea of areas going up, sinking, coming, that there could have been land bridges.
Well, they're pretty certain there were land bridges. So.
And there was the Silk Road,
mm-hmm.
that came straight through, like above India, and I guess it came from the Middle East and through India, and so all these ideas, by the people that were traveling were brought, and who's to say? I mean, we're looking at the depths as being around. So who's to say they didn't plant these ideas as well?
And then, of course, we mustn't forget Alexandria. We had Ammonius Saccas doing the same thing of bringing together all the religions and showing that they were all based on the same principles. And a freedom of thought and religion,
that was very, very spiritual. So there was a lot going on throughout both of the areas. Mm-hmm. Yes?
We are basically talking about something we might call divine wisdom.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't have to have spread via land masses and via people. It would spontaneously be planted by the adepts who don't need mm-hmm. land masses to travel.
Right. But
and
we think...
They are there. The spirit, you know, it gets planted wherever...
In order for something to stay and be protected, it does take individuals. Individuals have to stay and hold to that line and pass it on, which is why we're saying about the Shakers and the Essenes. If you don't have people to pass it on to, then it has to die out.
But those adepts who travel without a physical body would find those people in those areas who are ready to receive that wisdom and maintain it.
Yes, these ideas are inherent in everybody anyway.
Right.
And we would think that depending on somebody's karma then, whether those ideas will be expressed and carried on as was just said.
So we need to uncover before we discover.
Yes. We just found the Gita quote that goes with the one, all this universe is pervaded by me in my invisible form. All things exist in me, but I do not exist in them. Nor are all things in me. Behold this, my divine mystery, myself causing things to exist and supporting them all, but dwelling not in them. That is exactly what he said. Yes.
HPV makes a reference that if you look at the main areas of these ancient teachings, and you connected from Egypt to India, and you drew a line, it went right through what we call present day Iran. There was a line of teaching connecting different points on the earth at that point where centers were set up. And it's interesting that the Chaldeans or the Babylonians there, who got their knowledge from India, some of their mystics were the originators of what later became Sufism.
Yes, it's all interconnected, and who knows what we in past civilizations knew and learned and studied. We are almost out of time. Did you have a closing? We never talked about it. In the sayings of the Ancient One, which are out there for you to pick up, Patrick was allowed, even though he knew the secret Bantu language, he was allowed only to translate three fragments. And he said they point to a connection and common origin with the source from which stem all esoteric traditions. It's all one teaching. And those three fragments were the wilderness of the mind of man, the path to manhood, and the vision of the temple and the pool. And he made a beautiful quote, the description of the transmutation of hatred and the thirst for revenge into a passion of pity and desire to serve those who have injured you could hardly be more movingly beautiful. What a notion. Our meeting is adjourned, but we remind you that Easter, we will have the meaning and symbolism of Easter next Sunday, and then after that, ancient theosophy in Europe.